occupiers for months. The impetus for this panel was a 2013 lawsuit in which Leslie Klinger, most likely known by name to many of you, who is an anthologist of stories featuring Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson, sued the Doyle estate for declaratory judgment of the characters, at least as Doyle imagined them before 1923, were in the public domain. The district court ruled in Klinger's favor. Thereafter, the judgment was affirmed on appeal last year, and the Supreme Court quickly declined to hear any further appeal. Doyle was born in 1859, and he died in 1930. He was one of a number of prolific writers, Agatha Christie, P.G. Woodis, Edgar Rice Burroughs, who started writing before 1923 and continued to produce after 1923. Some of the questions I'm going to pose to the panel are: what's important about 1923? What is the public domain? Where did it come from? What does copyright law protect? What does copyright law not protect? And why do estates and transferees of rights have so much control of expressive material so long after the death of the authors that created it? Our distinguished panel, then, is going to touch lightly on copyright, copyrightability, public domain, iconic characters, ownership rights, and licensing fees. So I'm just going to tell you how we're going to do this. I'll be asking questions for around 45 minutes. Then we're going to open it up to the floor for questions, maybe for another 10 or 15 minutes. And then we have a clip that we want to show you, an interview that was conducted on Arthur Conan Doyle. The clip actually includes two parts. He talks about Sherlock Holmes, and then he talks about a subject dear to his heart, which is of no cultural consequence anymore, spirituality. Mm-hmm. We're only going to show you it's there in the clip, but we can send you around where the clip can be found on the internet. You can hear the entire thing, just in case we don't get to all of it. One of the things that struck me about it, and it's somewhat revealing of what we really mean about the business of authorship, just not the writing, but really being in business. The Sherlock Holmes stories appeared initially in the Strand magazine, and it wasn't immediately recognized that there was something new being presented. And at some point, the public began to realize there was something new. And Conan Doyle, in the clip, says that when the public began to recognize the newness of his characters, Strand magazine prospered. And then it should bring tears to one's eyes. Doyle said, "And so did I." The point is, and you have to you make it a business. It was a difficult environment then, and it remains a difficult environment for prospering still. So, I'm going to put my first question.
Actually, I'm going to interrupt for 1 second to show you how Doyle's life changed. The first Sherlock Holmes story appeared in Beaton's Christmas Annual for 1887? 97. One of those years. Long time ago. Thank you. And Doyle had sent it around. Doyle had sent it around to numerous publishers, all of whom said thanks but no thanks. Finally, Beaton's took it, but said he would have to assign the copyright to them for all purposes. For the princely sum, he was paid of £25. Later, in order to keep all his copyrights, he had to buy that copyright back from the publishers for a sum in multiples of what he was originally paid. Now I defer to our moderator.
There's a story about that in contemporary, or not so contemporary, but within the last 50 years, of an author signing a contract in which his character is owned by the publisher, only to discover once the book Red October became significantly successful that he didn't own the character, the publisher did, and the publisher came knocking and said, that's mine, incidentally. It wasn't a lawsuit, but it was an arbitration, so we don't know how it worked out. But as Andy says, it's clear that the author paid a multiple of dollars to get that copyright back. So my first question, actually, to Roger and Andy, but Lindsay and Neil can chime in. Klinger commenced his lawsuit against the Doyle estate because it was demanding what he, Klinger, didn't want to give. So first of all, what were the parties fighting over? What was the outcome of the lawsuit? And for an added bonus, was this decision, whichever way it went, we're going to keep you in tenterhooks as to what happened. Was this an important milestone in copyright law?
You want to take it first?
Well, first of all, it was not an important milestone in copyright law. That sounds disappointing, but what they were fighting about was the plaintiff who sued the Conan Doyle estate did not want to pay compensation or royalties for use of the character Sherlock Holmes. And the reason he sued was he maintained that the rights under copyright no longer existed for Sherlock Holmes because the copyright had expired years ago and was in what they call the public domain. Public domain means only that there's no copyright protection and no basis upon which anybody can demand compensation, and therefore it's free for all to copy. So that was the claim in the lawsuit. The twist of the Conan Doyle estate was they said, well, this character is a complexicated character, and therefore it shouldn't be subject to the general rule. The general rule is that when a literary work goes into the public domain, the elements comprising the literary creative material, generally categorized as storyline, characterization, and setting and locale, also go into the public domain and cannot be owned by anybody thereafter. And the argument by the Conan Doyle estate was this is a complexicated character who's not really defined in the first story, but over the years is added to in sequels, and somehow the mystical notion of character is not complete until all the elements of the portrait are added over the years. But the copyright law is that constitutionally, copyright is a monopoly, a property monopoly, and in the Constitution, Congress was empowered to grant for limited times two authors an exclusive monopoly so that they can control and obtain compensation for their works to induce the creation of creative works for the public benefit. So we start with a limited time. Congress was empowered, and they exercised that power since 1790 in successive copyright statutes to grant to authors the right of copyright, but for limited times. And over the years, the term has changed, but
the limit has become quite broad.
It's quite broad. More recently, it's life for works created after January 1, 78. This gets very technical.
Thanks, Sonny Bono.
Yes.
High
five. That's the
Mickey Mouse Act. Yeah.
The protection is life plus 70 years, and if it's a work owned by a corporation, it can be 95 years from the creation of the work or the first publication of the work.
May I add very briefly?
Yes.
Just to that statement, that in a creative sense,
I just want to add very briefly to that statement, it's all true, it's all legal, and it's all completely valid, but at a certain point, the creative work made by a person, if it has become extraordinarily popular, and this really only applies to works that have become extraordinarily popular, right? Does it belong to their children? Yes, of course it does. Unless they're disinherited, being a disgraceful pirate, which like theoretically wouldn't happen, right? Does it belong to their grandchildren? Yeah, sure, absolutely it does. They should be able to look past their fortune on. Eventually, does an idea enter the intellectual landscape, and does it become, instead of being something that is trademarkable or copyrightable, does it become something that is emotionally accessible and a touchstone? I mean, you can't copyright Jesus, right? But you can write Harry Potter, which is, and I'm being disgraceful here, but the stories are extremely similar. You've got somebody who dies for the world, right? And then comes back to life and is like, I'm back, you know? And you can't copyright that story. There's no way of telling that without having touched on all of those elements, right? So,
God is
questioning me right now. But sometimes, in order to tell stories that are about, you know, heroism and goodness and decency, it becomes very difficult to do so if you want to use characters who have already been used maybe over 100 years ago. And does it belong to their children? Yes, of course it does. Does it belong to their grandchildren? Sure. Does it belong to their great-great-grandniece's former roommate's ex-nephew? If it's an ex-nephew, I'm going to argue it probably doesn't belong to them. So that's just my reason.
Well, the copyright law would disagree with you on that, unfortunately.
I know.
Let me, one
and,
further.
Andy, perhaps you can talk about the elements of character. Which was discussed in the lawsuit.
Okay. One of the complications with the Sherlock Holmes stories is, as Roger said, now it's author's life plus 75 years. So Lindsay only has 3 Timothy Wilde books, but you know, they came out over the course of 3-4 years. Now they would all fall into the public domain in a million years from now, 75 years after her death. The Sherlock Holmes stories were under copyright from a time where it was not author's life plus, but a number of years extended numerous times by Congress after the first publication of the story. So in the Klinger case, 50-something of the 60 Sherlock Holmes stories clearly were published sufficiently long ago that they were in the public domain. The estate recognized that, said if you want to publish a book that has the first 50 Sherlock Holmes stories, you're free to do that. But 10 of the stories, approximately, and it's dwindling each year, were still in copyright. And as Roger was saying, the estate's argument was the entirety of the 60 stories is what created all of the elements that we associate with Sherlock Holmes. Yes, some of the accoutrements, you know, Watson, Inspector Lestrade of the Yard, some of that was developed in the early stories, but the entire Holmes character, his relationship with Watson, which changed over time in the stories, Their argument was, as long as any of the elements from the copyrighted remaining stories were being used or potentially being used by the authors of the Klinger Pastiche anthology, a license was necessary. And the estate asked for the grand sum, I believe, of $5,000, which is what Klinger and Laurie King, his co-editor, paid for their first volume of pastiches, or rather their original publisher paid the $5,000. You sold more books than they did, I think. In any event, when the second book was working its way through publication, the estate sent a cease and desist letter to the second publisher, the new publisher, who said, I don't want to get involved in a lawsuit. Get me these rights. If you have to pay money, pay it, or do whatever. I'm not publishing it until we have clear rights. And Klinger, being a lawyer, albeit a tax lawyer, as well as an author and editor, decided the best thing to do was to sue the estate to argue that unless you were using something specifically coming from the stories still in copyright, you were free to do what you want with Sherlock Holmes. The estate defaulted initially. It thought so little of the amount of money it could or couldn't get from this book that it defaulted. And if Klinger had just accepted a default judgment, it would have just meant that that book could be published and there would be no greater judicial decision. But being no dummy, he moved for summary judgment instead of moving just for a default. The estate then came in and responded to that, and therefore the court was able, albeit, as is clear to those of us from reading the decision, both at the district court and the circuit court, the judge never read the Sherlock Holmes stories, or certainly the ones that were being fought about, but was able to issue a judgment, and the judgment was that as long as you are only using elements from the public domain stories, you were free to use the Holmes character for that purpose. But if you used anything from the copyrighted stories, then you would need a license from the estate. On appeal, Judge Posner, who is a very well-known and well-respected judge, disliked the estate's lawyers unbelievably. And having listened to the oral argument tape, he was jumping all over them. And indeed, in one of the circuit opinions, he referred to my former client, the estate, as having an extortionate business practice in its licensing efforts.
Yeah, so.
Let me move on. Because I want to ask Neil about characters and Lindsay. Neil, about what's protectable about characters? What makes a character a protectable copyright?
It's very difficult to hear you.
I'm sorry.
Can you speak closer to the mic, I think?
Okay.
Well, addressing Lindsay's point from before as to what level of specificity is protectable and what's not, characters are protected by copyright only to the extent that they are very well defined. So, for example, a typical well-defined character would be a drawn character, a comic book character, because they're defined literally by their appearance. But in literary works, not every character is protected by copyright. They have to reach a certain level of definition in terms of distinctive characteristics and tendencies and a history. Sherlock Holmes is often referred to as the epitome of a protectable character, as would be Tarzan. In fact, I'd say most characters on Roger's list would epitomize what's protectable as a character. But a character who wears a trench coat and is in the rain a lot and cracks wise is probably not going to be protected. The name may have some measure of protection, but as a character, somebody in the next cubicle over could write a book also with that same relatively undefined set of characteristics and not infringe copyright.
Thank you. Everything that he said is true, and it also gets still more complicated than that, because if you take a character who exists and then you adapt that character in a new way, you have newly copyrighted all of the new characters that you have, you know, brought into that world. So let's take, for example, the series BBC Sherlock. So they have taken Sherlock Holmes and John Watson, who are absolutely in public domain in the UK, and they have added Molly Hooper, and they have added all of these other characters who are very important to the people who watch the show. Those characters intellectually belong absolutely to them, despite the fact that the original characters that they based the series on are ones that are taken from the public domain. So if you were to try to adapt something that was a modern Sherlock Holmes, you know, pastiche, you would not have a problem, as Elementary did not have a problem in the United States, even after they had solicited the BBC to endorse the fact that they wanted to adapt the series, and the BBC was like, no, thank you, and then they were like, okay, well, we're gonna do our own because it's perfectly legal, which is true. So, but the new characters that the people who start creating the new worlds, those people that they make up, they belong to them. So that's another aspect of it that becomes extremely complicated.
I'm going to add something. I'm going to tell you what Learned Hand said in 1930, which is the basis for the distinction that Neil made between what's protected and what's not protected. The idea for protection is that ideas and facts are not protected in a literary work. And when a character is too schematically presented, a man in a trench coat, a strong person who can fly, it has to go beyond that. But what Learned Hand said in 1930, and this is the basis for the law, he said, if Twelfth Night were copyrighted, it is quite possible that a second comer might so closely imitate Sir Toby Belch or Malvolio as to infringe. But it would not be enough that for one of his characters, he cast a riotous knight who kept wassail to the discomfort of the household, or a vain and foppish steward who became amorous of his mistress. It follows that the less developed the characters, the less they can be copyrighted. That is the penalty an author must bear for marking them too indistinctly. So that's the framework. There was some debate about what the law would be on literary characters versus graphic characters, but at this point, that's the rule that's been accepted everywhere in the country. So the question is, well, how do you know if it's defined enough? And the answer to that is you don't. It'll go before, if it's disputed, it'll go before a court, and some judge will try to make the distinction, and you could win or lose, but that's the nature of life. Statutes and laws are not sufficiently precise, as many things in life, to tell us what the outcome will be.
Well, I think you actually just brought up an interesting point. Sorry, if you don't mind, in my current voice commenting on it, you just brought up an interesting point, which is that you can't proactively prove that something is out of copyright. It's impossible legally. You can't go to a lawyer and say, if I write this story, is it unsuable? Like, can no one litigate against me? You can't go to any legal mind and say, could nobody ever, you know, try to approach me and, you know, get some cash out of it, because I was inspired by a certain thing. So instead, you have to either do it and be well informed about the copyright decisions and whether or not it's in public domain, or you have to do it in the realm of what's called fair use, which we haven't really talked about yet, but is essentially either parody or not for profit, and like a number of other things that that you absolutely could use it for. Because if Saturday Night Live wasn't allowed to do their sketches, where would we be? So, you know, everybody's allowed to do those sorts of things, but if you're making money off of it,
then you really cannot go to a lawyer and say, is this legally ironclad? It only exists after the fact that that you have either been litigated against or not, and it has either come down in your favor or not. Because you can't do it prior to
publishing. On the bright side, there are very few of those litigations.
Yes.
And most people are more than welcome to write their own stories and not get sued.
Yes, there are so few of them.
And the other
except
thing
for
is,
in the realm of Sherlock Holmes.
And the other thing about characters is that, remember, characters are just one element of a story. There's
but aren't we talking about
setting,
characters that are adapted?
That's our topic tonight, characters. But I'm just saying, in a larger context, bear in mind that there are other aspects of a story that are copyrighted with much greater ease than characters. The plot, the setting, the dialogue, the description, all of those things are very readily subject to copyright protection, as is a well-defined character. But there is that ambiguity that Roger was talking about that applies to characters, which really doesn't apply to the rest of a story, just to put it in context.
I'd like to ask this question. We're talking about the Doyle estate.
We're not talking about all characters, right?
Well,
I mean, okay.
When you're a writer and your business is writing, you either take risks or you don't. You could use a character that other people have used that's still in copyright, and use it, but you take the risk that you may be sued, you may not. But on the question of the Doyle estate is what I want to the panel to focus on, the Doyle estate. Who the hell is the Doyle estate? So, Andy, what's your take on this?
You know that.
All right, well, for many, many years after Sir Arthur Conan Doyle died in 1930, the estate was run first by his sons, Adrian Conan Doyle and, God, I'm getting old. Help me out. What's the other brother?
God, I'd love to.
Okay, anyway.
Call you a softball here.
Adrian
was the one who wrote
the other brother. When they died, the estate essentially, and when it was my client, the estate was run by Dame Jean Conan Doyle, the last surviving child, the daughter of Sir Arthur. There are additional complications because when Congress extended copyright, it gave the family, the author or immediate heirs, the right to terminate certain licenses, and there was a period because of mismanagement by Adrian and family squabbles among various wives of children of Doyle, etc., that the estate wound up in the hands of Sheldon Reynolds and his wife, Princess Midvani, aka Reynolds, who runs a bed and breakfast in upstate New York, and still to this day, despite several judicial opinions that says she has absolutely no rights in the stories or the characters,
Nancy,
still claims that she does own those rights. Jean Conan Doyle recaptured those rights from it being outside the family. When she died, there not being any direct descendants of Sir Arthur, since none of his children had children of their own, it went to a combination of grand nephews and nieces,
including Charles Foley,
and others, with rights also going to the British Library and various other charitable institutions, and then those rights from those outside the distant family were bought back in. And so the estate is distant grand, great grand relatives of Sir Arthur, and the current agent for the estate in the United States is John Lellenberg, who is also a, is or was a member of the Baker Street Irregulars, but that's beyond the scope of this talk.
Everything is going to the ex-wife's ex-nephew's former roommate's brother-in-law.
Which is what Lindsay thinks is not the right way to handle estates.
It could be.
But and for those of you who know, at the time Roger and I had our lawsuit, the agent for Dame Jean was someone many of you know, and that is Otto Penzler of the Mysterious Bookshop, who at that time was also running a small literary agency, and through his Sherlock Holmes Baker Street Irregular connections, he was, at that point, the estate agent. Now, as I say, it's John Lellenberg.
Let me just sort of segue into the date issue here. 1923. So Doyle wrote from the 1880s, died in 1930. 1923 is obviously an important year. He continued writing until 1927, another five stories. What is the magic of 1923?
Yeah, let me try.
Oh, yours.
The magic, as we mentioned earlier, is that Congress granted rights to authors to own their works and license them for a limited time. The problem, and what makes this complicated, is that there are two statutory regimes involved. In the 1909 Copyright Act granted authors the right to an original term of copyright for 28 years. It could be renewed for 56 years. But in the 1976 Copyright Act, which revised the entire copyright laws, they prescribed that the U.S. would follow European and other countries and have a term based on the life of the author, plus, at that time, 50 years after the author's death. And the question arose, what do we do about these other copyrights who had 56 years of protection? While they were arguing and lobbying about the new statute, the ones that would have expired from 62 forward were given another, they were continued each year until the statute passed, when they were given 75 years total protection. They took the two 28-year terms, added 19, and came up with 75 as fair for what they call the pre-78 or old works. New ones from January 1, 78 forward would be life plus 50, which later became life plus 70. So you have to go back for a work created before January 1, 78, and look 75 years from the creation of the work. The first work in which the character Sherlock Holmes was delineated, and therefore the protection of the character element in the first story was protected, was 1887. If you add, if you add 75 years from that, you will get up to a point, you can add it up at 70, but it's long past at this point. And for works, but what happened is for works that were created before January 1, 23, they had 75 years. For works created from January 1, 23 forward, the 76 Copyright Act had given them 19 years protection longer. This is the old works. But in 1998, in the Copyright Term Extension Act, the CTE, the ones that had life plus, had 75 years, were given 20 more years and given 95 years. But they had to still be in copyright in 1998 to get that extra 20 years on the 75. The math works out that anything that was created before January 1, 23 was no longer in copyright in 1998, and so it did not get the benefit of another 20 years to move from 75 to 95. And so the dividing line between still protected old works and those in the public domain was through the end of 22. All the old ones did not live long enough to get the extra 20 years. So anything today, anything that was created, meaning published in copyright from January 1, 23 forward, has got a 95-year term of protection from its first date of publication and is still in copyright. So that's the dividing line. It's very complicated. But you're working with two statutory regimes and a shift, one in the old act and then a shift to the new act, and then an attempt to just add specific numbers of years on to try to equate the kind of protection that new works get, which is life plus 50, and then it's now life plus 70. So that's the dividing line, and if you can follow all that. I've tried to repeat enough in the process to teach it a little, but it's not easy. What you have to do is open the statute, get out a pad, and put down the numbers and add and subtract and so forth.
Or don't write any Sherlock Holmes books for the next 10 years, and then you'll be fine.
Very, very uncomplicated. Anything before 1923 is in the public domain.
Right.
And everything after and until 2019, nothing in the United States will be going into the public domain. Which is problematic. It brought up the issue of the Walt Disney Company, because I heard Andy say Mickey Mouse statute. And Disney started his career after 1923. And that's what all the fuss is about. The fuss is about that Disney doesn't want to lose the copyright on all of his works, Mickey Mouse being the prime character.
Mickey got the benefit. But what I think Leslie was raising before...
Who's Leslie?
Lindsay.
I'm sorry, Lindsay, excuse me. What Lindsay was raising before is, well, how long should copyright last? It's limited, but how long should it go? Was Congress right in moving it this far out? Because the idea was to induce the creation of works by giving a reward,
yes,
an inducement to authors. Is it really an inducement to somebody sitting down and writing and creating that the fifth generation might end up, all the cousins and the grand cousins? And many people think that went too far. It was litigated and the Supreme Court did uphold it, but they didn't uphold it for the reasons of inducing the creation of works for the public.
What do you think?
One of the arguments was made.
Because I think they were upholding the rights of corporations to keep their money.
Well, they were, but one of the justifications given, yeah, is that because the Europeans moved from life plus 50 to life plus 70, mm-hmm, it turned out that one of the only industries in this country where we have a positive trade balance of trade is in the entertainment industry and in the movies and our music. And the people, the idea is we'd be damned if the Europeans could get our stuff for free earlier than we could get their stuff for free. And by the way, it helps our trade, our balance of trade. And there were commercial interests involved that did benefit the corporations.
Well, I would argue
that's the theory. I'm not saying it's right or wrong. I'm just saying that is thought to be the theory, not to just help.
No, I mean there
Disney.
Are other. No, of course, it's not just to. I'm sorry. It's not just obviously it's not just to help Disney, but there are other corporate interests involved because we haven't even gotten into the fact that artists are either work for hire or they keep their own intellectual property, and if an artist works for hire, that means that the corporation owns all of the ideas that they have created. So often if you're working for, say, a comic book company, or let's say, I have no idea whether you were working for Mickey Mouse, but I have worked for Disney before, and I have friends who have too, and so I know they hold very tightly to their intellectual property.
So it also has a great deal to do with which large companies are doing work for hire versus versus you retaining the intellectual property to your own characters. And I think that is very important to mention in this entire conversation, because if you have that property, if that's really true, then it lasting that long, I don't know, maybe in some crazy universe makes sense. But in the world of working for hire, it just guarantees a company essentially to hold on to your character with claws and not let go of it and not let other people use it, even though they didn't come up with it at all in the first place. And so I think that that's an important distinction to make, because work for hire and retaining your own rights to your characters are different things.
Okay, so we started this by, see, I told you this was a major subject. And I have, I made 10 pages of notes. So I've gone through 2 pages. And the 45 minutes. So let's open up the floor to questions.
I have a question.
Yeah, you were first.
I would like to know if there's a difference between copyright infringement and the actual theft of a story sent into Hollywood and then re-engineered with different character names by one of their established writers.
Neil?
Let me get a shot at that.
Yeah. That's, yes.
Copy, those two concepts overlap. If you've written a story and it's got a certain level of detail.
Can you hold
that
closer?
Sure. If you've written a story and it's got a sufficient level of detail to attract copyright protection, and somebody infringes that work, and you can demonstrate that they had access to your work, that could be copyright infringement, and often is. Sometimes those, sometimes stories are not developed with that level of detail. They're more bullet points, or they're more a treatment, or just a series of ideas. Copyright does not protect ideas. It only protects the expression of ideas. That is the expression through detail. So that, if somebody steals a set of ideas, that opens up potential liability, but not under copyright. There are other forms of legal protection against that kind of theft, the law of misappropriation, law of unfair competition, breach of confidence, breach of some obligation of confidentiality.
And there have been lawsuits in this area,
not in
New York, but well, in fact, there was a case in Southern District, but mainly out of Los Angeles. So,
yeah, now for properties that are like copyrighted, they can fall into public domain. For radio shows from the 40s and 50s are typically in public domain because they haven't done something to keep them in, and so that films can go into public domain even though they're clearly within our time period, radio shows. But what about books or stuff? How is that different from the other media?
It largely comes down to the period where you had to renew the copyright because it was 28 years with a second term thereafter. And I'll let my experts correct me. But if the owner of the copyright did not renew it,
okay. It
would then fall into the public domain. And that could be books as well as movies, music, radio shows, whatever.
It would be up to us to renew the copyright.
Whoever was the owner of the original copyright for works during that period where renewal was required to renew. Changed at a certain point again.
There was one other point. You had to, in the first 28-year term, you also had to register. This is the old days, no longer true. So if you didn't register it sometime in the 28th year and then renew it, which was due, usually you could renew by the end of the 28th year, you lost protection. And there's a whole area of artists and writers who lost protection. And the new law in part tried to eliminate the pitfall of that.
Yes, sir.
January 1, 1964 is the break point. the works that were copyrighted prior to January 1, 64, renewal was required. Works copyrighted on or after JIT for the first time, on or after January 1, 64. Renewal has a great many advantages, but it does not result in public domain status in its absence.
It's called automatic renewal.
Jerry?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I want to thank you all because listening to you was like hearing the story of my life. In 1965, I had a play on Broadway called Baker Street, which was a musical based on Sherlock Holmes. And I wrote it in the early 1960s, and I knew that none of the Conan Doyle stories would fit the requirements of what I needed for the musical, because there were certain elements that I felt must be in a musical, such as Holmes, Watson, the Baker Street Irregulars, Professor Moriarty, and Irene Adler. None of these stories individually had all those elements, so I knew I had to create a new story, which I did. I created a story based on Queen Victoria's Diamond Jubilee in London, which was the same period as the Holmes adventures. It ran on Broadway for over 300 performances, and also in Toronto and Boston. Now, the producer was Alexander H. Cohen, who liked it immediately, and asked me about the rights, and I said, well, I'm using elements of stories that I know are in the public domain. I'm using elements of Scandal in Bohemia, which is Irene Adler. I'm using elements of The Final Problem, which is Holmes and Moriarty going off the cliff together, and maybe one other. I checked on the copyrights of those stories. They were all 1891, 1893, thereabouts. Clearly, outside of the 56-year protection that we are used to as authors in America. And I presented that to Alex, and he accepted that. And he started to go into business of publicizing that he was going to do the show. And he started to hear angry sounds from a man named Henry Lester, who was running the show of the Conan Doyle estate in Switzerland.
Sure.
Does Henry Lester mean anything to you? You ever heard that? And Henry Lester made a lot of threatening remarks and said that he was going to sue. Alex went over there to talk to the estate people, Henry Lester, and Alex accepted my opinion that these stories that I was using were in the public domain, but he also knew that he could probably never get the show on because the people who are providing the money, and it's big money to put a musical on Broadway, mm-hmm. are going to say, we don't care what you do, you settle it yourselves, and then come to us, and then we'll give you the money. So Alex, for whatever reason, whether it's that reason or any other, Alex decided his best course of action was to pay the estate, which he did. And the estate came away with a 1.5% of the gross,
ouch.
And maybe some cash, I don't know what Alex gave them, but there was 1.5% of the gross, that I remember. And a guarantee of credit in the titles, which I was going to give them anyway.
My first novel, they came away with 8% of the gross from Simon and Schuster.
8% of the gross of the first novel.
Oh, yeah?
Not the same people, but it's still not cute.
Yeah, okay.
Go on.
So then Alex did pretty well then. Anyway, the show went on, and we didn't have any problems from the estate. Now, the Thames Whitmore Company covers the leasing of the show right now for stock and amateur usage. Sometimes they lease it for professional usage if they get permission from us. I'm the only surviving author.
Right, we're going to have to be, because I want to show the clip.
Okay.
We're getting the hook from our president.
Get to the questioning part, we'd like you.
We're going to be around. We don't have a meeting in May, but we have a meeting in June. And some of us are going to be here, so we can pick up. So yes.
Can I ask?
Yes, please.
So one of you mentioned that an author who inadvertently left the rights of his intellectual property rights in a character with the publisher somehow and then had to turn around and buy them back. What do writers need to look out for and avoid to prevent that situation? Or how does it happen?
We've had one particular contract. There's an author who would be here tonight, but it's his wife's birthday, so he's not here. But he showed me his contract from, I won't tell you the publisher, and he's published several novels. The contract of one of the major publishers in New York contains a provision that says the publisher owns the derivative rights of the work. I pointed this out to him. I don't think his character is going to become iconic. Nevertheless, he's given his rights away to the publisher. And what you have to look for, read the contract very carefully.
And if you see the words work for hire, then you don't own it any longer.
That particular problem of having a publisher latch on to the derivative rights is still relatively rare. But sure. It's not at all rare in motion picture agreements.
It's not rare in comic books either.
Well, I'm sure that's true, but in motion picture agreements, it's pretty much standard that if there's going to be a series, the initial studio will have first dibs on author-written sequels. Mm-hmm. And the way they're structured, it is that the author really can't go anywhere else with a character, even though subsequent books in the series are created. They have to come back to the same studio.
Okay, so Suzanne, let's get the clip underway.
Experiences and to take so much interest in that question. Well, first of all, about the Sherlock Holmes stories, they came about in this way. I had a young doctor at the time. I had, of course, a scientific training, and I used occasionally to read detective stories. But what annoyed me, how in the old-fashioned detective story, the detective always seemed to get at his results either by some sort of lucky chance or a fluke, or else it was quite unexplained how he got there. But he never gave an explanation how. Well, that didn't seem to me quite playing the game. It seemed to me that he's bound to give his reason.